This is Due by Friday, a weekly challenge podcast with Merlin Mann, Alex Cox, and Max Temkin. This week's challenge, play Dream Daddy, a dad dating simulator.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Max has his backpack again. I hope it is just an iPad. Just an iPad. Okay.
Oh. It's not mystery pills.
Okay, good.
It's not mystery
good.
Pills.
Got some.
We're not. That's only on the after show.
How are you doing, Merlin?
Don't complicate it. Are you going to tell us? Are you going to give us a postmortem on how that went?
Yes, in the after show.
That's 100% after show talk. Listen, people, if you want to hear about these mystery pills that Alex took, you can go to patreon.com/DubaiFriday and hear about all the great drugs.
Max, we are up to 991 members of Powder Nation. I almost said Cuck Nation. I don't think that's a thing.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so thanks everybody for doing that, but you can go and give us your money.
The dotards? Dutards?
No!
I read that as dutard. Lol.
Yeah.
I read that as dotard. Lol.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Never mind. We can't talk about Top Dress, but oh my god.
I'm very not caught up on Top Dress. But
you got a lot to look forward to.
I know. So here's what I know I have to look for. I'm like maybe two or three episodes behind, but I remember in the season premiere where they're like, this season on Top Dress, there was some sort of crazy controversy and someone
stormed out of the show, right?
I'm like holding my breath every episode. I'm like, ooh, there's gonna be some good drama.
Because you got a pretty good guess who that could be about.
Remember the guy, the Russian guy, like Sandro or whatever his name was?
The guy, which season?
Oh, it's a deep cut. It's like a B-side.
I remember lots
season.
Of Russian guys. I remember my daughter had a little bit of an unrequited crush on Dimitri. I think that was throwing good love after bad. But I love Dimitri. I don't think they were playing on the same sports team. But there was Dimitri. There was the bald guy who draped. Who else is Russian? The draping, there's always a draper. You ever notice that they bring in a draper?
I don't know what that means.
He's a draper, Jerry. A draper.
He's a draper! Yeah, the drapers. You know, see, now the interesting one, all you need to know is that there are gimmick people. And they're like, the first challenge, they'll go like,
the ding-a-lings.
Well, that's not the total ding-a-ling. It's somebody who has a bit. So I'm thinking of Rami, I think his name was. And Rami could drape.
Oh, all my dresses look like architecture.
Sculptures. Yes. Yeah. So he could drape a sculpture like ringing a bell. So the first challenge, you go, oh my God, I'm very impressed. I don't have concerns. You've made it work. And then like every fucking challenge, now he's draping candy. He's draping garbage. He's draping McDrape Drape. And then, of course, Nina and at the time, Michael would say, listen, we want to see more from you. I'm starting, you know what? You guys got to catch up. But I'm having those concerns a little bit. There's times
now.
Okay, I'm sorry. So just I just want to clarify for my records here. I like to just take notes. So what you're saying is you don't like it when you're not watching something other people are watching, and command you to watch it. Like you, ooh. Like what if I had like two shows?
Rick and Morty
like,
this week,
okay,
what about two shows like that that I demand
it was
you
very
watch?
Fucking good. This episode. The,
oh my god!
Nine
all
out
the feels.
Of 10 episodes of this season of Rick and Morty have aired, and it may be the most solid season of a television show that I can remember.
I haven't even watched it, and I can promise you that this is literally the greatest thing. If they would just stop hiring women on that show, I would feel so much better.
Oh, it's all gone to shit since they hired the SJWs.
Oh my god. What about those minor female characters that don't need to be main characters?
It's a show, I can only think of two or three other times in my life that I've watched a show and it's felt like this much of a miracle. Of like, wow. Every week you can watch it on and it's completely defies your expectations and it's so much, you go in with very high expectations and it's still incredibly surprising and good. I would say like Arrested Development felt like that when I watched it the first time. Like season like three of Parks and Rec, the first season with Ben and
Ben
Chris.
And, yeah. Season four of Seinfeld, I think, is a pretty miraculous end-to-end season.
Ooh, season seven of The Simpsons. That's a pretty good comedy season.
I like them a little earlier, all the Conan O'Brien years. No, but I'm totally with you. Did they do a retcon where Biff never actually found the Sports Almanac? Is that part of the show, or is that considered? Is that in the canon, or is that considered?
Okay, there's a big
it's
going to
be it's going to be even worse than when I made fun of musicals and I liked
Listen, Max, men like you, men like you can never Jacquard. Men like you can never change. I don't expect you to change. No, I know I'm going to love it. I know I'm going to love it.
The one with the guy and he's the prisoner.
Les Mis.
That's the one.
That's the one.
Remember how I made fun of it and then I liked it and I had to eat crow.
Well, let me quote the German Bertolt Brecht in saying that he also wrote Mack the Knife. It's you know what? I know it's going to fire back hard on me. It's going to be a bim bam all over again type situation. I know that when I watch The Horse Boy and I watch the Back to the Future cartoon, I know
listen,
I'm going to have
gonna
all the
say, I'm going to say that BoJack BoJack is not must watch. It's like fine. It's BoJack is a good show. It's like a better than average like adult cartoon.
Yeah.
It's. I don't think you're like missing out on popular culture by not seeing. There's nothing. I mean, I
Alex,
love BoJack,
Alex says
but
it'll wreck me if I watch it.
It's very. BoJack is sad. It pushes your buttons in a way that you watch it and you're like, it pushes your buttons in a way that you watch it and you're like, this felt important that I watched it. And I don't always love that trick, especially in a comedy. Rick and Morty is just so fucking funny. Like I can't. Yeah. It's like I can't stand it. It's so funny.
I kid, but it is truly miraculous to be there. It's one thing to go back and go, wow, the Honeymooners were pretty good for the time. But it's another thing to be there. I remember feeling this honestly with Seinfeld, where it was like week and The Simpsons, week after week after week. Each time they would just keep topping themselves with something that you'd never seen before, and that's important. That's two different things.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Like remember the good Treehouse of Horrors in seasons, let's say like
three.
I don't know,
four
yeah. through. 10 or something.
It started I think in season 2, but they were very, very good. You get the ones with like all the great shows.
Konos and Krang running for president.
Right.
Homer going into the 3D world is one of my favorites. But I remember watching those even as a kid and going like,
well, we get the Raven. I mean, I think it's the very first one, but it's just so good. It's literally just like the script from the poem The Raven.
My favorite of all time is when the dolphins take over the world and Lisa tries to be nice to them and they just poke her with a spear.
Dolphins are dicks. Everybody knows it.
They're
predators.
Bad.
They're predators. I think they're worse than manatees.
Got those Mike Cernovich smooth brains.
No, but listen, let me just finish my thought and acknowledge. I want to step out of the bit for a minute and say I absolutely will watch this. But I just think there is something very specialist. But even in the time of peak TV, where you could say like BoJack Horseman, like that's obviously a show that is extremely good, but you put it alongside something like that. That's what it was like kind of to be there with The Wire. You should really watch The Wire, Alex. But you watch a show and you turn it on and like every time it comes on, you're like, how is this even more of what this wants to be? It's sort of the compliment I've tried to pay you in the past about what you guys do, not just with your games and your whatnot, but your communications, your messaging. It's like, is this thing that we're about to do going to make us way more like who we are or way less like who we are? I think that's a fantastic business decision to always be making. And when you can see somebody taking those kinds of chances to become more like what they are and see it happening like day to day, week to week, it's magic. There's nothing like it. That's the best.
You're watching Veep.
Oh, God, I love Veep. It's my favorite TV show.
So, you know, when there's like some moments of Veep, like where, how do I say this without a spoiler? Where Selena's in a bathroom with Gary and they get some important news. That's probably one of the fun. And that's maybe.
Oh, you're talking
like
about
this...
with the Leviathan.
Yes. Gary, why do you
why
have
do you
this?
Have this?
That may be like the single funniest thing. Like I remember seeing that and saying like this is like nothing will be funny after this. Like this is it. We've gotten to the end of comedy and it's just the Trump children after this.
That show is over, you're like, you know, how was that ever? It sounds like the argument clinic. Like how was that ever 22 minutes? Cuz that felt like maybe a tight 8. How did you get so much stuff into that one? Or like Mike, all the stuff with Mike and the adoption and trying to lose weight and like all of it, all of the whole adoption thing and the continuing like removal of every ounce of his dignity.
He is the hero of that show. Like he's not maybe the most standout.
They're not
going
to pay him to write the
book. He's the fucking anchor that makes that show work. Like he works. He's like so small. He's so the way he does comedy. It's like so like micro. He's like a surgeon. It's perfect.
Yeah, I totally agree. Were you a fan of the UCB TV show on Comedy Central?
Oh, big time.
Mm. God, I love that show so much. Every time I watch an Apple keynote, all I can think about is when Leslie Knope goes to the job interview and it's the architectural firm. This is just in the woods. They're extremely minimalist naturally, and they're just sitting on logs.
Berlin, did you know that I had the titular line in Star Wars?
Oh, God, with all this traffic, will we ever get out of Africa? There is no titular line in Star Wars.
The line that got me on Veep, where I was like, I'll just watch this show. I'll watch every minute of this show, and it's the best thing on TV, is when Mike is trying to do the artificial insemination, and he has the cooler full of his like semen collections in the office, and Selena finds out, and she just sort of crosses her fingers, and she goes, "Mike, would you please do me the honor of moving your jizz bag from my office?"
It's a very, very good show.
Follow-up. Environmental Protection Agency is spending nearly $25,000 to construct a secure, soundproof communications booth in the office of Administrator Scott Pruitt, according to government contracting records. The agency signed a $24,570 contract earlier this summer with Acoustical Solutions, a Richmond-based company, for a, quote, privacy booth for the administrator. The company sells and installs an array of sound dampening and privacy products, from ceiling baffles to full-scale enclosures, like the one purchased by the EPA. The project is scheduled to be complete by October 9th, according to the contract. Typically, such soundproof booths are used to conduct hearing tests, but the EPA sought a customized version, one that would eventually cost several times more than a typical model that Pruitt can use to communicate privately.
And they think there's a belief, there's somewhere in there, there's a line that's like, you know, really, the truth is everybody should have one of these. Like, everybody in the cabinet should have their own private booth.
Someone said, EPA spokesman Liz Bowman said, quote, federal agencies need to have one of these so that secured communications not subject to hacking from the outside can be held. It's called a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, SCIF. This is something which a number, if not all, cabinet offices have, and the EPA needs to have updated. But according to former agency employees, the EPA has long maintained an SCIF on a separate floor from the administrator's office, where officials with proper clearances can go to share information classified as a secret. The agency did not specify what aspects of that facility were outdated or whether the unit inside Pruitt's office would meet the physical and technical specifications that an SCIF generally have. I mean, he's one of these crazy Trump cabinet guys who, like, he probably goes into the office and he has some directive of, like, don't look the administrator in the eyes, don't speak to him. Right. He doesn't want anyone to talk to him. And I mean, I get it. He's like, you know, it's like Betsy DeVos, like, gets, like, booed, you know, by people when she goes to, like, schools or Department of Education functions and stuff like that. Like, she's adversarial, right? Like, he's one of these guys who's trying to, like, actively, he's taking political orders from the president. He's sacrificing the independence of the department, taking political orders from the president, and basically undermining and dismantling the department that all of these civil servants have given years of service to. So it's like, who puts like a decade of their life into being a civil servant for the EPA because they believe that we should have, like, clean water, and then they have any respect for this guy who comes in who does Trump's, like, political bidding and like, you know, one of Trump's first acts, well, I actually think it was, like, the first thing he signed was an act that, like, deregulated coal plants so that they could, like, dump coal power runoff into the clean water. So it's like, who gives 10 years of their life to the EPA and they're like, yeah, I'm going to be, like, a civil servant and government employee and, like, go to work protecting the American people. And then this, like, asshole comes in and he has some memo where it's like, don't make eye contact with the administrator and let me pollute my streams. Like, of course you'd have to, you'd never leave your office. You're in occupied territory.
There's also an Occam's razor to this, though, which is you look at the wonderful story of the New York Times reporter. I forget his name. I know it, but I've forgotten it. He's sitting at lunch outside. He's at a steakhouse outside, I guess, roughly equidistant from the New York Times office and the White House. And who but the lawyer Ty Cobb is sitting there talking loudly. I mean, you've heard this story, right? You've heard the story that this Times reporter overheard this discussion about McGahn having documents, et cetera, et cetera. The beautiful little color on that story, and of course, and saying that now there's lots of concerns inside the White House that people might be wearing a wire, like for Mueller or for somebody else. This is all part of this conversation. The beautiful, like, coloring in of this conversation, it's a New York Times reporter, like, I think, like, 8 feet away from that table, sitting with another New York Times reporter. The New York Times reporter leaves. And on three occasions, the reporter's like, I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to scope out what these guys are saying. On three different occasions, other New York Times reporters walked by, hailed and greeted the New York Times reporter at the table to say, hey, how's it going? And he's all, shh, including Maggie Haberman, who I'm pretty sure most people would recognize in D.C. Ty Cobb is still enjoying his BLT steak and talking about wires. What I'm trying to say is I think there's a huge amount of concern inside this administration. About basically getting narked out, about the, some kind of low-level commissar overhearing what you're saying and reporting back to somebody else, because clearly it's just all full of leaks. So he wants to get this man-sized safe that he can put in there and have this little quiet room that he can be in. And isn't it sad that most of all, I come out of this and say, I wish I had 25 grand, because I think I would enjoy having a skiff. Just a little private time. Wouldn't you love to have like a little skiff? It's just like getting a little hug from your room. Wouldn't that be nice?
No. Max, no skiff, you have no a skiff lot of for friends. You. No. Now I'm like claustrophobic. Okay, Max, you have a lot of friends who've like worked in Washington and worked in the White House as civil servants. And I keep thinking about the This American Life episode, The Revolution Starts at Noon, and Act Six. There's a change in the office climate. And it's all about like the folks who are sticking around, and like you said, they've been civil servants for like 10 years. Are there are there like low level people who are on their way out and are like, yeah, I'll be wired, I'll be a leak?
Well, there's a division between political employees in the White House who sort of like do communications and do the president's agenda, mm-hmm. and then bureaucrats who work in the federal bureaucracy. So mm-hmm. the key, I mean, there's. I don't want to get into the whole thing, but the key distinction is the political people, the employees of the White House who work for the president, they leave with the president.
Yep.
The civil servants who work in the bureaucracy, the employees of the EPA, they remain no matter who's the president, right? The EPA is an independent organization established by Congress that is supposed to be the reason that we have the EPA. It makes and administers law. Like these federal agencies are structurally weird and possibly somewhat let's say constitutionally dubious, although obviously the courts have like upheld their rights over the last 200 years. But they're the only place in government where you have all three parts of government basically functioning under one person. They're legislative, right? They make power. They're executive. They have a top person, Scott Pruitt in this case, appointed by the president, who has executive function and makes decisions with the president's constitutional authority. And they're judicial because they have courts. And like, let's say that you live downstream from the coal stream and you want to sue the federal government or challenge the regulation saying my drinking water is unsafe, like that there's a chance that that would become I actually don't know if this works with the EPA, but some agencies do adjudication, so you would wind up going to them for that. So the reason, why do you have this crazy setup with these bureaucracies? Well, the theory when they were created this way by Charter of Congress is that they would be immune to the political winds of Washington. So whoever the president was comes and goes, public sentiment comes and goes, people believe one thing one day, one thing the next day. It's crazy. It's very, you know, sports-like, right, in Washington. And you want the environmental policy of the country, the theory is, well, there's no Democratic or Republican way to provide safe drinking water to people. There's just the right way to do it. And you want these, like, qualified experts to make good law and good policy and enforce it and be immune from the political changes in Washington that push them one way or the other. And, you know, like a lot of things in America, in democracy, all of these systems and all of this power worked if you had a sort of benevolent philosopher king at the helm. And, you know, like we've said this before on the podcast, we've talked about how this works in so many different ways, but Trump found the flaw in the American Death Star, and he flew his little X-Wing right in there. Mm-hmm. Like, the system was not built for this.
It's not funny. I'm just doing the laugh at a funeral. Goddamn. What a funny show. That was very helpful and interesting. Though.
No, it's
Thank
true.
You.
We never figured that that's the kind of attack. You never think that that attack could happen. Like, why would you need to defend that? You assume that it's going to be a person of goodwill who's a rational actor. So why would you need to, like, you know, cover up this 2-meter hole in your star?
Yeah, now I'm sitting here with a hacked iCloud account going, well, I never thought I'd get hacked that way. I didn't defend against that.
You got hacked?
Hacked. No, I just, some people
can
got
I control
hacked.
Your screen, Max?
Yeah. How do we, can you do that? I'm on my iPad. Can you?
Yes. I'm Apple certified.
Zeus Troyan detected.
Zeus Troyan. You guys.
I think Merlin's wearing a wire.
Oh my God! Where's my skiff?
I think it's like the famous character Jimmy Wire says on The Wire when he says the titular line. You hear it all on The Wire.
Let me get this straight. You're out here and you're wearing a wire. Are you wearing the wire?
At last, we've got it. We have found the wire.
and my wire.
About my lady Gary friend, the clown that was finally caught.
Alex, you've sent a number of texts to our super secret secure channel that was probably hacked in the iCloud breach. And I don't understand any of them. There's like something involving veterans, and there was a break-in. We've not really. Can you explain that? Pretend I don't know anything about this story, and then tell me the whole thing from the beginning.
Okay, part one. I bet this was during one of like your important talks or something.
No, I think it was more likely when you were enjoying some special new pills.
No. This is.
Communicating with you, Alex, is sometimes a little bit like talking to my daughter, where it's. We're coming home from school, and I can tell she's excited about something, but I can't tell if it's a real thing she read in a book, a fake thing she read in a book, or something someone said to her on the playground. And the more questions I ask, the less sure I am about what's actually happening.
No, Merlin, it's from Prisoner of Azkaban.
Okay. rejoice.
Living beverage.
Okay.
Read another book, bitch.
Don't challenge. It might have been from the Half Blood Prince, but a couple.
You just well actually yourself.
I did.
You got cucked by Cox. Do 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 do.
I should slip myself a 20.
Breaking. Clown girl.
We're gonna get so many tweets about this segment. People are gonna be like, at 0-2600 in the podcast, I didn't understand the joke. Could you explain it to me? No, you got to pay $20 on the Patreon a month to get our super secret text message thread.
You go to patreon.com/dudebyfriday, give us your fucking money. You'll be confused, but you'll have less money.
Otherwise, the podcast is only funny to three people.
Yeah.
Of what?
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 Oh,
what?
Sorry. My computer.
It's your story.
I have not.
Alex, collect yourself. Tell the story.
I'm sorry.
You ever really look at your hand? I mean, really, really look at your hand.
All right. This article written by the Palm Beach Post is long and boring, so I'm not going to read the entire thing. But the year I was born, a woman was shot and killed by a clown in her own doorway. So she... There's this clown shows up with balloons and some flowers. The clown hands this woman some flowers, shoots her in the head, and for 27 years, this murder went unsolved. Turns out the woman who shot her was her ex, current, now ex, I don't know, widower? What would you call him?
My ex-widower.
Her ex-widower, the lady that shot her was his special lady friend. So for the past 27 years, they've been together. And other than the two times he went to jail for other shady things, and they caught Crazy Clown Lady because she bought balloons at the Publix across.
Wait, just
the street.
Now they just caught her.
Yes, they just caught her.
I followed the article that when this was still a mystery. There's such a wonderful, I'm glad you caught that. There's such a wonderful line in this. The focus veered to Keene, a striking young woman with long brown hair and brown eyes, after police in October 1990 said the clown was a woman. Deputies found only one Publix in Palm Beach County that sold the kind of Mylar balloons that the clown carried.
Oh, good old Publix.
All right. That all makes sense. I just got one more question for you. What these kinds of Mylar balloons...
That's some, you know what? That's some pretty good detective work.
Yeah. You know what? Good on them. Here's the thing, though. I bet someone was just popping in to Publix to get some of their lovely Farm Fresh products.
Shopping is a pleasure. They went in to probably get a delicious sandwich.
Not to insult the detectives of Palm Beach County, but you know, it did take 27 years.
Yeah, I think as they say on The Wire, they liked her for the crime. They just couldn't put it together.
I caught her, Merlin, and she didn't even fucking know it.
At last, we discovered.
Had her on the wire.
Let's close this chapter about education with our discovery of the wire.
Now back to the docks.
We're going
to
shut down these docks with a wire. Dateline, next door. Neighbor Denise. Subject line, dog folks, beware. Crystal meth. Be vigilant about what your dog is sniffing and tasting out on the streets and in the parks. On Saturday, my dog walked from Dingle to Dingle Park and then started acting agitated and confused. We took her to the ER, because apparently there's a dog ER, and a urinalysis showed that she had crystal meth, otherwise known as speed, in her system. We are not sure where she got it. She was hospitalized and is still not entirely well. Please be cautious, as the vet said, there's a huge upswing in the cases she is seeing of both speed and marijuana poisoning in dogs. Neighbor Jen says, hey, Denise, that is not okay. Did the vet say people were doing it intentionally, or did someone just drop their stash on accident? It's me, Jen. Neighbor Melinda says, if the dog ate human poop, that'd be one place it could have happened. Neighbor Denise says, good point. I hadn't thought of that.
Ooh.
Developing
the
story.
The mystery deepens.
Yes. Who's
someone
eating
had,
meth
like,
where?
Intact meth crystals in their poop?
I think it's like corn. You should ask Veronica about this. Corn has something called a cell wall. And I think meth has a cell wall. It does not fully, you ever eat peanuts? And then the meth.
It's not fully metabolized.
No, it
what
doesn't
do you
matriculate.
Do you ever eat peanuts? What
do
you
eat
talking
peanuts?
About?
What are you talking about?
You
what?
Poop out peanuts when you eat
oh,
them?
Oh, sure you poop out peanuts. You're like a
are
monkey.
Are you eating them with the shells?
I mean, sure. I mean, if they're salted, no.
Hey,
no.
Can I ask you a question?
Challenge.
My friend Brent eats a bag of peanuts while he sits on the toilet and then throws the shells into the toilet and flushes it. And he owns at his house, he owns like one of those like Roto-Rooters, his own personal Roto-Rooter, because the toilet clogs so often because he's flushing the peanut shells.
Oh, shit, dog.
The question is good or bad?
Is Brent good?
Oh, that's complicated. Well, first of all, if you have the means, I highly recommend it. Like, if I knew that I could put literally fucking anything in the toilet and then deal with it by myself, I would be flushing so much.
You've got
more
your
stuff
own.
Down
you
toilet.
Own your own personal Roto-Rooter. I mean, you could flush a Chicago Tribune down that toilet.
You just know you. Could, but think about no. Just think about the confidence. Just know that, like, setting aside that you could just shit a monster into there. Like you could make a peanut burrito in there and it would be fine. You could just anything. You take all the wipes, you guys, all the wipes that you could throw in there. We went camping this weekend and we had to poop in what's called a honey bucket. It's one of those portalets. It's a very large portalet, like it's a handicap accessible portalet, and there's just a great steaming pile in there. And it makes like a pitcher's mound of human effluvium. And that's what we had to use for 2 days for our business. But you know what was nice is we brought wipes. We brought super wipes. We brought super emollient, super wipes. And I'll tell you, man.
You brought tactical survival wipes.
These are meant to be, I think these are for people who bike to work and can't shower. It's like a dude wipe. But the thing, when you undo it, it's like the size of two paper towels. You guys, there is nothing like dropping into a honey bucket, taking out a wipe the size of a paper towel and knowing you can just clean that entire area and just say Hakuna Matata, you throw it right onto the pile. It's such a good feeling. If I could do that in my home because I own my own Roto-Rooter, you think I wouldn't do that? I'd be eating peanuts like a crazy person.
Well, you live in San Francisco. Have you ever considered getting... Well, all right. Question one. Do you compost anything, Merlin?
I can already say A, yes. B, no fucking way. Yes, we compost heavily. We do about 60 pounds of compost a week.
Holy heck.
Because we got a separate container. No, we don't have some little toy size. We've got like a probably 30, 40 gallon like separate compost thing. We have garbage, we got recycling, we got compost. Composting toilets, you can't flush anything down a toilet in San Francisco. There's signs everywhere about what you can't put in a toilet.
I mean, think about the freedom you could have just to have a little bucket by the side of the toilet.
Well, Alex, when you're pooping, if you knew that you could put anything in there, what kind of stuff would you put in there?
Maybe some special pills that I was nervous about someone finding. I don't know.
What about macaroni and cheese? If you had leftover macaroni and cheese and you knew to a certainty, a near certainty, that you could put half of a pan of macaroni and cheese into a toilet and flush it without consequences, would you do it?
I mean,
why? What's
yeah.
the what's the what's to be gained?
Well, it's freedom, Max. Basically, a consequence. It's a consequence-free garbage can. You're not going to smell anything.
I flushed a pie down a toilet one time.
What kind of flavor? What flavor it did not go well, did it?
do you remember what flavor it was, Max?
It was a beautiful banana cream pie from a very good bake from what's that famous bakery in San Francisco?
Oh, JJ Bakington's. Yes. Wait, Aramendi?
Yeah, that might have been it. Okay. No, they have like a famous cookbook. I can't remember.
Tartine.
Yeah. I had a beautiful banana cream pie from Tartine, and we couldn't finish the whole thing, and then we thought, I wonder if it'd be funny if we flush this pie down the toilet. And we did, and it turns out it was very funny.
And in the world of baked goods, that's considered a Viking funeral.
Yeah. It did mostly, to be honest, we had to chunk it up a little bit, but it did flush. And then this was at CBS Studios in San Francisco. And then now in that bathroom at CBS, they put a little plaque on the wall saying, please do not flush anything down the toilet except for toilet paper.
I'm going to put the video in the show notes. Max is downplaying the disaster.
There's a little clip art of a pie on the sign. From Corel Draw.
Oh, boy. I have a lot of Trump's rowdy adult sons news about them. Do you guys want to hear about Trump's rowdy adult sons?
Oh, for sure.
We've been talking about how bad they are at email and like how insecure the whole email operation is. Obviously, now it's out that Jared Kushner and a bunch of these people just use like personal email addresses that can be easily like spoofed and faked. So here's a great, and we've talked in the past. We've actually had other stories on the show about this too, about how people like spoof their email addresses and trick people into corresponding with them. Like we think that happened with like that whole thing with like Scaramucci and Rance Priebus and all that. So it happened again to Jared Kushner. Someone spoofed Jared Kushner's email address and emailed Abby Lowell, the one of the attorneys representing Trump. So this is from purportedly from Jared Kushner. It's kushner.jared@mail.com wrote, Abby, it's only just occurred to me that I had some correspondence on my private email that was of, well, a sensitive nature, namely some exchanges with a website featuring adult content. Can I remove these? Jared, sent from my iPhone. Abby Lowell writes back, forwarded or received from White House officials? Jared, fake Jared again. I think one was forwarded from a White House official. We had discussed a shared interest of sorts. It was unsolicited. Then there were a handful more, but not from officials, sent from my iPhone. Reply from Abby Lowell. I need to see, I think, all emails between you and the White House, just for me and us. We need to send any official emails to your White House account, not stuff like what you asked about. None of those are going anywhere. Fake Jared Kushner replies, but we can bury it? I'm so embarrassed. It's fairly specialist stuff. Half-naked women on a trampoline, standing on Lego scenes. The tag for the movie was hashtag standing on the little people, frowny face emoji, sent from my iPhone. Abby Lowell writes back, don't delete, don't send to anyone, let's chat in a bit. Fake Jared Kushner writes back one last time, thank you, Abby. There's one more, video link. I'll be sunk if it's found out. The protagonist of the piece looks exactly like a younger Hillary Clinton. Hair's got a little more of a choppy fringe, though. That one I have deleted about a week ago, sent from my iPhone.
Oh, my God.
So this is just what happens in their lives. It's like teenagers from the internet spoof their email addresses and start porn crises.
Oh, my God. Oh, boy. I'm just waiting for the day that there's a Kushner Ivanka sex tape that's leaked.
Gross.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I know someone them, like, who would enjoy
imagine
it.
That, who?
He oh, happens Trump. To be the leader right. of our free world.
No, I got two words for you, Handmaid's Tale. Except there's no woman in between them. They just sit.
No,
she just sits on the bed.
Thinking about them like fornicating is very upsetting to me. They produced an offspring, didn't they?
I think they made
many.
Several.
They did.
Oh, they have like children?
Mm-hmm.
Newsweek. Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr. were embroiled in a battle to take away inheritance money from their sister, Tiffany Trump, according to a new archive of conversations Donald Trump had on air with the
She's
Howard
so
Stern
Peggy.
Show. Donald Trump told Howard Stern that Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. weren't happy when they discovered they'd have another sibling and agreed when Stern asked whether the two were working together to, quote, bump off a child. Quote, do your older children get nervous every time you have another child? Stern's longtime co-host Robin Quivers asked, referring to the children's inheritance. Every time Donald Trump has another child, the others are at risk of receiving less money. Oh, thank you, Newsweek. Exactly how much the Trumps will be inheriting is up for debate. Quote, I have a friend who is also, like, a very rich guy, Trump said to Stern, according to the tapes. Quote, and he said how his children hate the new children coming along and everything else. I said, yeah, because every time you have a child, it's 20% less to the people, inaudible. The conversation quickly switched paths to the subject of, quote, making love to Melania during the pregnancy, but not before serving one last swift blow to Tiffany Trump. Stern asked Trump if Donald Jr. and Ivanka were trying to, quote, bump off the other child. Trump responded by saying, quote, Tiffany is great. I have a great child. And Tiffany, I have great children. Quote, Tiffany has taken out a hit on Melania's new baby. Is there any truth to that? Stern asked. Trump shot back, quote, well, you know, it does cut up the pie as you keep producing.
Man, I get how people feel bad for Barron, but I just forget Tiffany exists all the time. Oh, I know. Poor Peggy.
Daddy says we should bow my son down.
Yes. Yeah, that's complicated stuff. There's so much. I think I couldn't stop thinking about it. I mentioned this last night on Twitter, but, you know, when Trump started, well, see, I think it's so silly when people say, when people call Donald Trump's Twitter account Donald Trump. It was silly with Ted Cruz. It's silly with all of these people. Let's just say that somebody who has access to Trump's account started deleting his Big Luther tweets. We should mention this. I did not know about this. Did you know that ProPublica follows, tracks deleted tweets for people?
Yeah, it's actually been controversial. Twitter's held in some cases that that's a violation of their terms of service.
Oh, what a shame.
That it's like misusing the API. So sometimes that stuff gets shut down. But there's also Congress. There's a couple of these. There's one that deletes deleted tweets from a congressman. And then my favorite one is Congress edits Wikipedia.
That's so good.
Yeah.
And it's often like fantasy, like Marvel movies and Harry Potter and stuff, isn't it?
Oh, it's all kinds of crazy shit.
Yeah. But I just think it's going to be so interesting. And I'm pivoting here, but like last night I was wondering aloud to myself, like, it's going to be interesting when the story is told by somebody, when it is in the future, when the story is told and we find out exactly how much and how Trump used Twitter. That's going to be super interesting. I think it's going to be very interesting to find out exactly what Dan Scavino's role in all of this is. We know that he's basically at the level of a ninth grader in AV club in terms of using iMovie and stuff like that. We know that he loves to use little tools on his Mac to make little things. We know he likes to make jokey memes that are actually not particularly meme. Well, he's not very good at his job.
Little Ken Burns effect slideshows.
But you know what I'm saying? It's going to be fun. Here's the thing, you guys. This story will be told at some day. Some point in the future, and we will find out there will be reenactments where we'll see his meaty, tiny little girl hands typing on his little Android phone. We're going to see reenactments of all of this. We're going to learn someday. But the role of people like Dan Scavino, we're going to find out questions like, who decided which Big Luther tweets to delete on a Tuesday night? Who did it? Who approved that? I think the crazy stories are still so much to be told. But basically, I just want to say Dan Scavino is not very talented. He's really not good. He's not good at his job. Whoever is doing, I mean, it's amazing. Here's like a fact that gets left on the table a lot. I know this is not going to be a popular thing to say, but we see that anytime Donald Trump manages not to shit himself in public for 36 hours, people fall all over themselves to talk about the cliche is how presidential he is. But you can tell that this entire country is dying for him to become less rather than more crazy. Like everybody that's not in his audience would love the opportunity to go, phew, he's 20% less batshit insane than he was last month, and he's sustaining it. This is a story that's it's hiding in plain sight. I imagine this is the kind of thing that John Kelly thinks about every day. It would not be that hard for Trump to pivot to being just a little bit less crazy, and people would fall all over themselves. But like, isn't that kind of what makes it extra crazy nutty? is that he could so easily have such higher approval among people that aren't in his 37%. But he's so attached to all of these ding-a-lings that he can't stop acting crazy. And the people around him just enable it.
There was a very good story. I actually don't want to get into this. I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole. But people should check this story out. It was in the New York Times called Trump's NFL Critique, A Calculated Attempt to Shore Up His Base, on September 25th from Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush. We'll put it in the show notes. The basis of this story is they talk to all these Trump people, and they're like, you know, the White House is at a very difficult impasse right now, because in order for anything to get done, Trump has to make reasonable bipartisan deals with the Democrats. So it's going to happen on immigration. It happened on the debt ceiling. Like, it's going to continue to happen, right? The Republicans can't govern. You have two parties, right? You have a party that's interested in governing and helping the people. That's the Democrats. And a party that's interested in tearing down the government, the Republicans. And the country can't survive that way. And Trump is, we all know what side he is on, but now he's the president. And in order to carry out the minimum functions of the office, he has to work with the party that wants to govern. So he's going to have to compromise. And whenever he does that, his base revolts, right? So when he did the debt ceiling deal over Chinese food with Democratic leadership, the Republicans were in like open revolt and saying like, you know, tearing up their, burning their Trump hats and throwing them in the garbage and stuff like that. So what he does, what does he do? And this is the argument that Glenn Thrush and Maggie Haberman make, and they have many sources who back them up on this. What does Trump do? He picks some bullshit culture war distraction that really has nothing to do with governing the country and throws a little red meat out to the base, right? Like, here's some bullshit that everyone can get. You know, he's going to poke the hornet's nest and fight some dumb culture war battle because it brings the base back on his side. So I think that's more or less all you need to know to understand why is he engaging with North Korea in the way that he does? Why does he treat all the crazy shit that he does? Why is he doing this nonsense with the NFL? It's like, are these like winning political issues for a majority of Americans? No. Do they make Trump look good to most people? No. It's just that it's his only way to hang on to the base. He's got to throw them some red meat. He's like, you know, hey, here's some, you know, Charlottesville, I think, falls into this camp, and it's got to be like, hey, here's some racist bullshit that everyone can get mad about for a week, and you know, you can we can engage on these sort of like culture war issues. And you know, I don't mean to for people to take from that like, well, we shouldn't talk about these things or care about them, because I think, unfortunately, like, when the president says it, you know, listen, no one would love more than me not to care about the NFL, but I think once the president says it, it's a thing. Like, we have to.
Strategies for victory. I'm talking about, like, just if we can take a step out of that partisanship and look at it in a cold way in terms of how effective they are at their job. That's the part I'm talking about, really. When I talk about Scavino and all these ding-a-lings, and I mean, think about everything we've learned from Parks and Rec. We've learned that, like, you probably shouldn't send a dick pic to everybody in the department. We've learned that when Donna tweeted publicly, when she thought she was tweeting privately, that caused a lot of problems, right? There's all these things we know from Parks and Rec. There's the stuff that these folks are doing, even like the ding-a-lings, are stuff that would not be tolerated. It would not be tolerated inside of like a medium-sized company. And then to have, it's just so crazy that the CEO at the top of that is doing the craziest of all of it. That's the part that's nuts. And that's why I keep coming back to when this story will be told, it's going to be funny to see. It's going to be insane to see how many bad decisions compounded to get us to where we are now.
I think one of the really interesting examples of this is the like Luther Strange, like Roy Moore primary that just went down. So basically, like, the sort of Trump wing of the party led by Steve Bannon got behind this absolute fucking lunatic in the Alabama Republican primary, Roy Moore. And Trump and McConnell and the establishment sort of tried to like fight the Trump base weirdly and backed this guy Luther Strange, who's also kind of a nightmare, to be honest, but less so than Roy Moore. And Strange lost pretty badly last night. But it was very interesting because Bannon did an interview and someone was like, because he was very publicly supporting Roy Moore, and someone asked Bannon, like, well, why did Trump back Luther Strange? And Bannon said, well, he's very easily misled. He's very easily persuaded. He's like a simple guy, and he got bad counsel. And like, what a fucking own that is on his former employer and his boss, right? The guy that he put in this position to say the guy's basically a simpleton and he'll listen to whoever's in the room with him. I mean, I don't doubt that it's true, but it's crazy that they just say that out loud like that. I mean, you know, that how easily manipulated he is, how little command of the issues he has, how little he understands.
And how stuff. Like it's so clear from his actions it's, you know, it's so easy to overread into what's happening. But if you just keep coming back to, he cannot be seen to lose. He likes to be associated with winners. So even as he saw, and the little bit of the backstory on this was that he was pulling for Luther Strange, Big Luther, and he kept tooting about it more than he usually does. I mean, not as much as football, but more than Puerto Rico. And so he's been talking a lot about Luther Strange. And then he goes down to Alabama because guess what? How do you get him? What is fish food for Donald Trump? Is like getting to do a rally. So he goes down there, he does this rally, but he does this really, the night before, it's like a very half-hearted endorsement, and he actually says on stage, maybe I made a mistake when talking about endorsing this guy. And then when it does go down, the tweets start disappearing, because he, and apparently he's internally furious about this, because now he's associated with somebody who's not a winner.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts on this, but number one, first of all, I would love for things when I say things on the podcast that turn out to be wrong. They should be deleted. In fact,
I think that's Alex's
job.
It was
when I say some information that's wrong about philosophy thing, I was talking about that Bertolt Brecht, and I got some information wrong about him
on the podcast.
And here we are. Here we are.
Facts here.
And here we are in our $25,000 isolation booth with all of our equipment and technology. And Alex's only job is to delete my old tweets so that I sound smart in retrospect. Is that so much to ask?
It's not so much to ask.
Go back to the ones before the election when I said Hillary was definitely going to win and be like, I don't know. I don't feel good about this. She should be going to Wisconsin more.
Patreon.com/DueByFriday. We'll get a fact checker for the show.
We should do a quick check-in on what Tiff is eating. Our friend Tiff Arment likes listening to the show on her iPad while she has some food. Got to give you a quick update on what Tiff is eating today?
Please, Merlin. What do we think Tiff is eating today?
Today, Tiff is having lunch. She's having deconstructed bantam goose ham sliders with tessellated frisson of endive and a flight of huckleberry cran yam jams that's served at room temperature and sliced diagonally.
Wow, that really sounds good. You can have all that delivered and more with Blue Apron. Use the checkout code...
sliced diagonally.
What's the joke from this? Isolation. Use the checkout code isolation booth at checkout.
Fix it, Alex. Fix that.
Fix it in post. Follow-up. New York Post. A North Korean defector is told of Kim Jong-un's teen sex slaves, lavish caviar lunches, and gory public executions. Hee Yan Lim, 26, is the daughter of a high-ranking soldier from Pyongyang and a member of the regime's inner circle. But when her father, Colonel Wei Yun Lim, 51, passed away, she and her family decided to flee the country in 2015. Do you guys know how do people flee from North Korea? How does that work exactly?
How do you
flee?
How even do you do that?
Because it's like not easy to get out of the country, and like I think there's like landmines between North and South Korea.
I had the impression that there were like North Korean coyotes, basically, kind of the same. I'm sure there's a Lovely Planet Money episode about it. We'll try to find that and put it in the show notes.
Send Alex an email if you know how people defect from North Korea. But now in South Korea, Hee Yan has spoken of what life was like inside the secretive rogue state. She told the Mirror that she saw, quote, terrible things in her home city of Pyongyang, despite her family's relative privilege. She said officials came to her school to pick out teen schoolgirls to work at the chubby dictator's homes. The escapee said they would only choose the prettiest girls who were taught to feed him caviar and massage him. First of all, I don't like how they're saying this like it's like so scandalizing. It's like, what are you going to go pick up teen girls for your palace and you're not going to pick the prettiest ones? Like,
right.
Like I don't
kind
like,
of
why do you have to
lead.
Call like yeah. why first like why do you have to call that out? Like it's like some sort of like, can you believe they did this? Like he didn't and he did and the worst part, this is such like
you guys, we need to talk about the role of lookism in slaves.
it's such a crazy liberal perspective on it. And like, and he only picked the pretty ones. Can you believe it?
It's why
like,
don't you abduct the less pretty
why,
girls?
Where were
I won't
the,
see ugly girls
the
because every woman is beautiful and should be kidnapped.
Sex slaves. Like, can we not get
all the women.
Curvy teen sex slave
I
in the dictator's
my,
palace.
Oh, I
love
my
slave.
I love my curvy
body.
Teen slave. Oh my God, look at her. She's so broad. She's only had her lady blood for 3 years, but she has such fecundity in her breath. She's so hungry. She loves to feed me caviar. And you can tell she's so hungry, and I can see the sweat just pouring down her beautiful, beautiful broad back.
Hee Yan, who has met the despot, also said, told how he would dine out on imported delicacies like caviar and Chinese bird's nest soup, which can cost $2,700 a kilo. here's why this story caught my eye. It's from the New York Post, so it's probably made up, but wildly exaggerated. But this sounds like the kind of racist bullshit that's like does not pass the smell test and is transparently made up that we heard before the war in Iraq. Do you guys remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about the palaces.
The palaces. I remember very clearly one day I was in the cafeteria at school and I was a pretty big asshole and all I wanted to do was like rant and rave about politics and no one wanted to talk to me about it. But I would all these fucking kids in my school, liberal school, were like very pro-war, like they were wearing like flag shit and they were talking about how bad Saddam Hussein was. I remember one day at the cafeteria table in high school, Julie Klein sat down and told me that Saddam Hussein had meat grinders in the desert that he would put people into. And it may have specifically been Jews, but I don't remember that part. Oh, and I remember saying, listen to yourself. I was like, do you hear what you're saying? You think he has meat grinders in the desert and he feeds human beings into the meat grinder? Like,
how would you maintain a human meat grinder?
You would get
in the desert
hair
environment?
Everywhere. We would gum it up.
Yeah, you get hair and you get sand in the grinder.
It would be very hard to maintain. My fucking shower drain clogs with hair and I'm not even putting a whole person in there.
Right.
It would never work. It's one of these things of like, it's like some kind of cognitive dissonance or something of like people find themselves about to go to war and then they're able to make these unbelievable logical leaps, these incredible mental gymnastics to other and dehumanize these people. And like, I'm not trying to say like, yeah, like I don't know, maybe Kim Jong-un like does have teen sex slaves or whatever, but like so does lots of world leaders. Like I just like, it's like, that's not a reason to go to war with him. Like it's just
right,
like,
right. Well, it's not so entirely different from the canonical example of the Jews kidnapping Christian babies to turn them into matzo bread. Isn't that the kind of the canonical classic example of a crowd panic about the other?
I don't appreciate you're imposing your normative values on our religious traditions.
What, do you just get the pretty babies?
What, are you going to get an ugly baby to make your matzo?
Who's gonna want to eat an ugly baby?
Yeah.
What, Jonathan Swift?
That's just common sense.
There was a really good, I can't believe I've started listening to this. I can't believe I'm listening to a daily news podcast, but it's very, very good. I have to admit. I know it's popular, but The Daily. The New York Times' daily podcast with Michael Barbaro is very good. It's different every day. I was just listening when we started recording today to a very chilling episode. At the height of the 2016 election, exaggerated reports of a brutal crime turned the town of Twin Falls, Idaho, upside down. Do you remember the story? Did you hear about this?
Go on.
So basically, at a town meeting, a bunch of in Twin Falls, several people showed up at the same town meeting to talk about what was being done about the crime. And everybody at the meeting is like, "What crime are you talking about?" Long story short, this meme starts that Syrian refugee teens. This is not pretty, so I'm sorry. I should trigger a warning here. But the story that they told was that Syrian youths had gang raped a 5-year-old girl at knife point and urinated on her. So I'll cut straight to the chase. It's a story that endures today, even though what actually happened in these tiny kernel of truth in that story is not that. What happened was, and it's not pretty, but like basically there were some kids between 5, 7, 10 years old that had some sexual contact. The police couldn't talk about it because they are legally barred from discussing cases involving sexual assault in minors. This got turned into, you the police are for Sharia law and refuse to talk about this. And now our children are being raped and urinated upon by Syrian refugees. There's no Syrian refugees in the town of Twin Falls. This never happened. There was no knife. There was no urination. But that story was so sticky because of how much it bolsters. And of course, Bannon. Bannon was one of the people out there saying, this is an example of everything you need to know about Islam in America. And that's a story that endures to this day because it supports that worldview.
That's insane. Speaking of... this just reminded me of another delightful thing I saw last night. I was Googling some fun Roy Moore facts once he won the nomination. And I saw...
We need a theme song for that. Fun Roy Moore facts.
A fun Roy Moore fact. In between talking about what an abomination homosexuality is, there was this amazing interview that he gave during the campaign. So this is with the reporter Jeff Stein. Stein asks, some right-wing conservatives think Sharia law is a danger to America. Do you? Roy Moore. There are communities under Sharia law right now in our country, up in Illinois, Christian communities. I don't know if they may be Muslim communities, but Sharia law is a little different from American law. It is founded on religious concepts. Stein.
A little different.
Stein. Mm-hmm. Which American communities are under Sharia law? When did they fall under Sharia law? Roy Moore. Well, there's Sharia law, as I understand it, in Illinois, Indiana, up there. I don't know. Jeff Stein. That seems like an amazing claim for a Senate candidate to make. Roy Moore. Well, let me just put it this way. If they are, they are. If they're not, they're not.
Yep, that's true.
I don't know how you argue with that.
I guess I agree.
Can't really argue with that.
Yeah. Dig Dug, I don't want to give the melty face Google guy like more attention, but did you guys read the New York Times story called Push for Gender Equality in Tech? Some men say it's gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that like really stuck out. Okay, well this is my favorite part. Mr. Altier, I don't know who this guy is. Said that in a gathering he hosts in person and online to discuss men's issues had grown by a few dozen numbers this year to more than 200, that the private Facebook pages he frequents on men's rights were gaining new members, and that a radical subculture calling for total male separatism was emerging. It's a witch hunt, he said in a phone interview, contending men are being fired by, quote, dangerous human resources departments. Quote, I'm sitting in a soundproof booth right now because I'm afraid someone will hear me. When you're discussing gender issues, it's almost religious. The response, it's almost zealotry. And it's a really stupid article. But what's worse is they have these like really like incredibly posed photos of like tech dudes in like trying to look very serious. And so you've got this melty face Google guy who I feel like showed up in a t-shirt and they had like maybe one of their photographers like, oh shit, take off your shirt and give it to him. So he has this like blue button down that doesn't fit. And then the Reid Hoffman, who's the founder of LinkedIn and who has asked to sign a decency pledge, and it's kind of unclear what that is leaning against a banister, like so, trying to look casual, and he's got like this weird muffin top thing going on, and it's just, oh god, I hate when people are like, oh, this reads like an article from The Onion, but these photos are just so good. They're so good, and I'm glad that we're talking about this on an audio
Well, at the risk of being, I'm only going to say this incredibly on-the-nose thing, because I happen to know Max will agree with it. This week's This American Life, episode 66,
so
White Haze, is, okay, all usual provisos, it's This American Life, it's heavily produced, you know, and not everybody likes Zoe's voice. Go listen to episode 66, White Haze. It is essential for five reasons. That's all I'm going to say about that. It's just like what the picture that arises out, what you learn about the Proud Boys and what you learn about the incredibly aggrieved. You know, you get so tired of that cliche about millennials being these snowflakes in their parents' basement. And then you listen to this, the aggrievement of people who actually believe that they are being formally replaced, that white people are being replaced by non-white men. Non-white,
fucking
non-men
gall of them too to turn around and call us like snowflakes and say that we're doing grievance politics. Like, it's so fucking funny. Like, they're scared of everything. Like, everything is a threat to them. Like, the whole guy who started the Charlottesville rally, he was like radicalized.
This is Kessler, right?
Yeah, he was radicalized because he didn't get a job. And it's like
he didn't get a job. They gave it to him. There were two jobs available. One was a full-time job and the other one was an as available job, and they gave it to a woman because they always give jobs to women. And that's why he's sad and wants to, and his feelings are so hurt. Yeah, I'm not a racist. My feelings are so hurt that you're calling me a racist. Like, I'm not a white supremacist. Stop saying that.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I thought that the This American Life episode was exemplary. I think it's an incredible piece of journalism. I really don't have any issues with how the episode was produced. I mean, it is interesting though. So I heard this, and all throughout what I was thinking is it's amazing to me how well, like, I wish that they had made a, if I, let me not say that I wish they did it. If I produced that piece, I would have taken it to a systemic critique. Because if you look at the Proud Boys, like the reason that they're a gang, right? Can we just call it a gang? I don't know that we even have time to get into too much detail. Everyone go listen to this week. We make fun of the
listen to it, because they do go into the whole like no masturbation thing you guys told me about. That's like a huge part of these guys.
Huge, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's crazy.
They're an insane fringe gang, and we will definitely be making fun of them on the podcast.
But they're dinglings. That's the thing, is they're dinglings. They're not. It's not even like the Klan. These guys are like serial dinglings.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I listen to this, and they formed a gang, right? And I'm thinking, well, why does anyone form a gang? It's because they've been excluded from capitalism, and they're not really able to provide for themselves according to the way that American, like, culture, you know, especially for men, right? There's this whole conception mm-hmm. of how men are supposed to provide for themselves within this very sort of narrow parameters of, like, being a man, pulling yourself up from your, to the man's man, pulling yourself up from your own bootstraps, being self-sufficient. There's this whole, you know, there's a lot of value placed on that. And when that doesn't happen, it's easy to blame everything in your life, not having a girlfriend, not having a good place to live, like all these issues on that. And this is why people form gangs. I'm not talking about white supremacist gangs. This is why people in the ghetto form gangs. It's why juggalos form a gang. It's why anyone forms a gang. And it's sort of a response of like, well, we'll do it ourselves. We'll build our own community of mutual interdependence and have our own values, that because we can't sort of participate in this capitalist thing. Anyway, that's the...
Well, and also you create your own symbology. You create your own lore. There's all the ways that they use, like ironically use phrases like taken out of African languages. There's this entire like code to being inside of there that makes you feel very included.
Right, an initiation of sort of
gotta
fake sacrifice.
Get punched in the face while naming cereals. I mean, it's bizarre.
It's so weird, but it's like a thing that you sort of earn your way into in a increasingly like less trivial ways, and then you have this feeling of value and belonging that you're denied from other aspects of society. And I kept waiting for there to be a systemic critique and to say, well, these people have been left behind by the systems that are supposed to be working for them, and so this is what they're turning to, and we've got to do a better job of like providing for these people. And it was sort of denied in that story. And obviously, I think you could say the same thing about Kessler, although he's more of like an anecdote, right, of the idea that he didn't get this job, so he decided to become like a radicalized, like, white terrorist.
And but, that's where you get into the This American Life part.
Well, yeah. And that's fine. And that's fine. But it's like, well, if you want to, if they're, you know, it's so whatever. But my response to that anecdote is like, well, maybe he should have had a job and then he wouldn't have become radicalized. And maybe it's not to say that he was owed that job, but... You know, whatever. Dude has a college degree. Like, he should be able to get a job in the economy, and he wasn't, and that gave him free time to, you know, start this Unite the Right rally or whatever. So, but anyway, it's just interesting that I heard it, and I was like, immediately was like, well, where's my materialist, you know, a critique of like how this all fits together? But I then posted it on Twitter, and the other thing that you need to know is like the other character is this like pickup artist guy. Black guy who became betrayed by the Proud Boys as they became very racist. And I posted this on Twitter, and a number of people were like, I hated this story because it's like the story is like this sexist pickup artist is the protagonist, and then he's like betrayed when it's like, my sexist movement became racist too. And, you know, I get that. Sure, that's a fair critique of the guy. Like, but it's just interesting that this fall.
But it's another example of like only kidnapping pretty girls. It's like, well, you know what? This is all ridiculously complicated. There's no clear winner. There's no clear protagonist in all of this. And as long as you're always looking for who's the protagonist and the antagonist, you're going to miss the thread. Nobody thinks they're an antagonist. Everybody thinks they're the hero of the story.
Well, I mean, you know, it's like it falls almost exactly along the lines of this ideological divide on the left, right? Where it's like on the one side you have the people who are I'm going to use the popular terms here, although I'm not to say I necessarily agree with these, but they're the sort of identity politics people, right? Who feel like our most urgent
the intersectional aggrievement movement.
Yeah, and they feel like our most urgent issues are like, you know, gender equity, racial justice, and I don't deny that those are urgent issues. But and then on the other side you have the people who are, you know, maybe more of what I'm into, which is the like, well, the best way to address racial injustice is like basically economically. Like you have to give people reparations, make sure everyone has jobs, everyone can participate in get a house, participate in the economy and get paid a living wage. Like that's like, you know, that I would view that as sort of the top way to do it. And not to say it's like not a legitimate debate, but we also did just lose a national election, like leaning heavily into the first camp. So, you know, I'm looking for a way to try the other one now. And it's just fascinating to me that even the story of, you know, this sort of character study of looking at the Proud Boys, like, just neatly, like, the egg cracks in half, and you've got, you know, two people hear this story, and they take exactly different things away from it.
Yeah, I mean, we can basically turn something like that that is so fascinating and such a character study and so indicative of something big in our system, and it always comes down to a way to figure out how we can argue amongst ourselves about who we should dislike more.
Right, right, exactly. Is it this group or that group who was hurt more by the story?
That's not how you make policy. That's not how you move forward with stuff. You don't... That's basically how you play Pokemon. That's not like how you win an election.
Should we get into the challenge?
Let's talk about the challenge. All right. I feel like we need to segregate this challenge into a couple of... delete where I said segregate after we just had that conversation. I feel like we need to address this challenge in a couple of different parts. I think we need to have Merlin's software corner where he talks about Steam, and then we can talk about the Dream Daddy game.
I got a lot more to say about one than the other. That's for dang sure.
All right.
Okay.
Merlin, tell us about installing Steam, which was not really part of the challenge, but more a thing that you had to do.
Challenge this week was, I guess, install Steam and play Dream Daddy, a dad dating simulator.
We don't need to drag this out. This will make the challenge. You know what? We shouldn't talk about it. I'll talk about it if you want, but I don't want to derail you.
So Steam is made by this company called Valve. And Valve, when I was growing up, basically made the coolest video games. Like, mm-hmm. They were one of the best computer game companies. They made Half-Life. They made Team Fortress 2. They made Portal. They made all these different extremely cool games. Everything they made, they were one of those companies that for a while, every single thing they put out changed the industry. When Portal came out, it was like, video games will never be the same after this. When Half-Life 2 came out, video games will never be the same after this. And I think they did like Counter-Strike 2, which I never got super into, but that's like the number one like competitive shooter video game.
Is that
game,
the one, what's his name plays in time. The Reply All episode?
Yes, it is, mm-hmm. Actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So these were like huge, mega international blockbuster hits. They were one of the most successful game companies. And they decided, you know, we don't want our games, you know, to be sold in stores because the retail business for software was very, very broken and bad. And they had a hard time, you know, obviously negotiating to get their titles into stores and all of that. So they were like, we're just going to build our own digital distribution thing. And they made Steam. And Steam was, when it happened, it was a revolution. It was the first mainstream digital distribution for games thing. Among the revolutionary things that they created was the idea that once you bought the software, it lived in your library and you could re-download it as many times as you wanted, so you had a true feeling of ownership. They instituted like anti-cheating measures to make sure everyone would play fair. So if you got banned for cheating on Steam, it was like a real ban. You know, all that kind of stuff. And eventually everyone went on Steam. Like, Steam is like the central repository for games. It's a
really good idea.
It's a great idea.
Very, very good idea. And especially if it's cross-platform. I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And the true tragedy to me is that Steam became so lucrative and such a big project, and it's so packed with features, and now they make like fucking hardware and VR shit and all this different stuff in the Steam world, that they don't make video games anymore. Like, all their talent has gone into doing Steam. And I think, I guess, like, there was a, did you see that Mike Laidlaw blog post, Alex, of like the plot of Half-Life 3? So it seems like maybe Half-Life 3 will never come out now. But anyway, that's the true tragedy of it. And I think the internal logic over there is like, well, we shouldn't be making games because we're so good at making software. And that was what was going through my mind when you were talking about your experience of using it.
I'm trying to find out when Steam came to the Mac, but it took a while because I didn't play Portal until it was like it was on PlayStation 3 because Steam, well, and that's the thing, Steam does still sell its their games on other platforms. And it's just, I don't know, it feels like Valve used to, like, there was that article that was like, we don't really have, like, a structure within Valve, and, like, we have this, you know, horizontal management system, and you can tell, I feel like, now, especially with no Half-Life, no Portal 3. God, it ended on a cliffhanger, and I don't know, it also feels like the actual software of Steam is kind of stagnant, but I don't know. That's my opinion also because I use it on a Mac.
I don't have much to say about this that's going to be appealing to anybody. I'm just very picky and weird to the verge of being a crazy person about what I put on my computer. Like, I consider this an area where, like, it's already, you're hanging by a thread, like, with the computer as it is. I don't update my OS usually for a year after it's come out at this point. I'm just very conservative about what I put on my computer, and I have very high expectations and a lot of suspicion about everything. So, like, when I get stuff like pop-ups asking me to, like, authorize admin things, I usually hit cancel and go figure out what it looked for. I'm out there, I'm Googling for stuff from the console. Like, I'm a paranoiac about what I put on my computer, partly because I have really good taste, but also just because I'm very conscious of the fact that there's a lot of powerful stuff that people click through and that there are signs that you learn from as a user of hardware and software. On the Mac platform, it is sometimes farcical to me. If somebody attempts to do some kind of malware, it is farcical with how much it is obviously malware because it does not look like anything from the Apple world. Nobody with any taste would ever ask you to click on that box. Like, you go to some of these, like, those sites where you get, like, free hosting, and they obviously are trying to give you some malware version of Flash. You have to update your Flash. And you're like, it's obviously not Adobe. It's obviously, you know what I'm saying, though? You get to this point as an Apple and especially Mac user of going, like, oh, God, you're not even trying to make that look real. That is so fucking fake. There's no way I would ever click on that. All right. I know that is an old-fashioned way to be. If I had, as Jeff Venus said, a passionate task of wanting to get to this goddamn video game and I'll hit any button to make it happen, fine. Hakuna Matata. As somebody who's been doing this stuff since 1987, when I see shit that does not look Apple-like, I am very reluctant to let it do things. So first of all, I tried to download this shit on my MacBook Adorable. It wouldn't let me. The file I was trying to download said High Sierra in the name. I don't have High Sierra. I have regular Sierra. Fine. I probably don't want it on my laptop anyway. Everybody says it's dog shit.
I called Sober Sierra. Sorry, that was a bad joke. I'm done.
And then I went to my work Mac and I said, okay, I got the challenge. I got to do this. And I went to download it. I went to install it. Every square inch of this looks terrible. And looks fake. It has fake. It looks like it's running on, I assume, something like Java. It's doing some kind of runtime bullshit that has absolutely nothing to do with the Apple world. There's nothing standard about it. When they add things like the three little dots in the top of a window, I think they're just little images they dropped in from an old version of the iOS because it looks nothing like the actual actual OS. It's basically like a talented toddler's drawing of an application on a Mac. So when I got to the point where I finally installed that shit, after I went, I got to pick a username and I got to pick a password. And I got to get through the caption. I got to get all that bullshit. Great. Now Thorstensen Finlanson is officially on the Steam. I downloaded. I clicked to install it. Wow! Suddenly there's ads popping up everywhere. There's ads popping up. There's bullshit in the background.
No, it's a 35% off Dishonored 2, Merlin.
Yeah, rejoice, rejoice. And I see non-standard UI elements. And guess what? I get a really sketchy looking pop-up that says, this application wants to get into your accessibility to have special controls. I closed all of that. I went into our super secret private channel. And I said this app is bullshit. I don't know, man. I get why you want to get in there. You probably don't want to waste a lot of time making a good application.
For a while, Steam would like render fonts wrong. Like, they had, like, Windows font, like no anti-aliasing on the typeface. Do they still do that shit on the Mac?
No.
I don't have Steam
when
on my
software
Mac.
When software is ugly and feels careless, that is a huge fucking red flag.
I will say it looks more at home on a PC. But
Looks stupid anyway.
Where everything looks bad. And there is no standard UI, and nothing is trusted, which is one of the reasons that every PC person has, like, six bars on their browser that are, like, you know, virus cleaners or something like that. And it's all just emailing their hard drive to Vladimir Putin one packet at a time.
This is not interesting to gamers or to Mac people. That's all I had to say, and I'll be done with it, was just that it was an unpleasant and ugly experience. And the first time you launch an app, having it launch an ad and then want me to do basically allow accessibility stuff that I let maybe three apps ever do is not a turn on to how to start. Now, maybe that's bad on me. It's like my whole PlayStation sign-up experience where I'm an idiot. I'm not a gamer. I don't care about games. I don't like video games. I don't like this world. But, like, that was a real turn off to me before I even got to the time where I got to make my delicious fuckable dad.
Okay. So that's it for Merlin's Tech Corner. Merlin, what are you going to review next week on Merlin's
pound
Tech
sign
Corner?
Merlin shit list. Pound sign Merlin shit list. I used it, but I don't like it.
Real time follow up trademark, John Syracuse. It is written in Objective-C on the Mac. All right, let's get into Dream Daddy.
All right, Alex, please explain this game to our listeners and tell us why you picked it to have us play it.
All right, so first, were either of you familiar with dating simulators before? I mean, they're self-explanatory.
Yes. Oh, my God. Every spare minute of the day, I'm doing dating simulators. Every platform, I get it on Steam, I get it on Vox, I get it on PlayStation. I can't simulate enough dating in my life. I just have so much time to fill with dating simulators.
All right, Dream Daddy, a dad dating simulator. I chose this game because I know that Merlin isn't a huge fan of video games, and this is sort of like an old school text adventure type of thing, except updated for the modern era where you just date dads.
you hit return and read. Yeah. That's video games, right?
It's a game that is on a video screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And so you, at the beginning of the game, you create the dad that you want to embody, and then you are introduced to your young daughter, and you have moved across town, so you need to meet all of your neighbors who just happen to be hot dads that all live in your cul-de-sac, and you have the option to romance a number of them and eventually fuck some of them. And that's about it. And then the game ends once you have gone on a third date with one of the dads and sealed the deal. And however, there are different endings. So I want to get into what kind of dads you guys created and what dads you romanced. And most importantly, it took me for a ride, how you interacted with your daughter, Amanda.
Well, I think the first thing is Merlin and I both made dads that looked almost exactly like us.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much 100%.
Yep. Mine, I made the closest dad possible to me.
Why would I go in a video game where I simulate someone that looks like me?
No, I don't know. Why would you do anything?
Opportunity,
why
if I had any opportunity to be anyone
else. Why get out of
bed
in the morning? It's all, you're going to die eventually.
That's what Gandhi said.
Yeah. I made it look almost exactly like me, and I spent a lot of time in the character creator evaluating all of the different hairstyles and t-shirts that I could be wearing.
Sorry, I did it wrong. Yeah, my guy is super fuckable. He's an out and proud, happy dad who looks a little bewildered.
He looked surprised.
He's like this. He's got a shirt.
That would
got
be
a
the sound effect that your guy would make when he was talking. Your guy would go,
He's got a shirt with a cheeseburger on it. And he's surprised. Your guy, wait, now hang on. Is Artemis Longhorn, that's you, Alex?
Yes, I named my character.
He looks like Travis McElroy.
I designed a man that I would like to embody, but also I wasn't sure how much you played as the dad. So I also wanted a dad that I would ideally fuck. And he has a very smart little jacket and then a button-up shirt that has cats on it.
Is there a picture of your dad somewhere in here?
Yeah, it's in the super secret text channel, but I can put
it. It's also in the Google Doc.
The last thing that I see is my funny tweet that Michael Barbaro made.
Look at the Google Doc. It's in there.
Mm-hmm. I named him Artemis Longhorn because he has a big penis. I'm not good at jokes. What did you guys name your dads?
Oh, I don't remember.
How can you not remember? You played him for hours.
I played for 5 minutes. Oh, I know his first name is Panzer. I wanted to give him a tank name.
Mm.
I'm going to find Max's in here somewhere.
I named mine Max Temkin.
Wow. Video games really just really stretch out. Let's see here. Max Temkin. There we are. Oh, look at that. You got Steven Seagal. Wow, look at that guy's hair. Astonishing.
Oh, Alex.
Oh, there you are. Yours is good, Max. This is really good.
This looks like someone, and I'm not going to say who it is until after the podcast, but it's very funny who it looks like.
I
can't say who it
looks
like.
Okay. All right. I'm nervous.
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
I
should
have said
all
that
right.
A lot. Anyway, Merlin, did you actually only play for 5 minutes? Did you meet another dad?
I looked at some Polaroids.
Did you romance anyone?
Nope. I looked at some Polaroids with my daughter. It seems like it's going to be a lot of feels, is what it feels like.
I don't know. Well, you didn't play, so you didn't get to any of the feels other than the fact that your
husband installed. Died. listen, I set aside 2 hours to work on this. I installed Steam. I got an account. I got it installed successfully on a second computer. And then I spent 15 minutes hitting return and reading while a cartoon character moved a little bit.
I should have had you guys play the
I get full fucking
game.
Credit for this. Full credit for this. I made a little man.
I played this game. I played for an hour. So I didn't get to the end of a story. I think it has like a 3-hour playtime or something like that.
It's about 2 hours
for like one storyline. So I didn't get to the end of one. But I'll say I'm going to go back and finish it at least once. I'm romancing the guy from the cafe.
Oh, he is a hottie.
He was my first. He was the first one that jumped out at me.
Is it fun? Were you enjoying that?
Yeah, it's a wonderful. Yeah. It's a wonderful game. It's not a 6-course meal. Right. It's a little cookie. You know, it's like a little.
It seems sweet.
It's a little treat. It's a little treat. It's not. It is not going to win Game of the Year, but it is uncommonly well written. The characters are very well realized for a video game. I thought that it had true moments of shock and delight, like when you get to the Pokemon battle.
Yeah, it's so cute.
I mean, shit. That's one of. I mean, I stood up out of my chair. I was so excited when that happened. It was so funny and so charming. It was very human for a video game. I mean, even dating sims tend to just be weirdly cold and inhuman. And I love the daughter character. I love the main character, the dad. I think they did a great job with it. I think really my only critique of it, you know, a game designer or game critique is really that I felt like the I guess I have a better version of Merlin's complaint, which is the interaction model was very limited. Like they're just, I'm familiar with the conventions of dating games, and even by the conventions of dating games, I feel like you make too few decisions in the game. And I understand why, which is scope. Like it's hard to make a game where you get to decide everything. So I understand why it is the way it is. But that being said, I wish that there were more opportunities for decision-making and role-play.
I agree. Like, I was kind of surprised by the limited, like, text tree, if you will. However, I got to the game, and so this is, like, spoilers for my end of the game, and I did not realize how many choices actually had a very heavy impact on how you played the game.
Basically, just for people who haven't played it, like there's several points where like you get to, it's pretty, at least in the part I played, you get to a pretty simple, like, do you pick this one or this one? You're saying that has an impact down the line, like a callback or changes the story.
Well, like for example, I decided to romance Joseph, the married youth, the married youth minister who has 4 very creepy children and a wife who hits on you if you go to a bar. But then for one of our dates, we go to like this dance and I'm supposed to help out. And there's like these options for choosing how to resolve a situation, or you choose what dance moves to do. And they're all like very silly. But by the end of the game, I had chosen, chosen Joseph, given him the rose. We went out on our yacht, had some very romantic moments, and eventually went down to the bedroom of the yacht. And he confessed that he had already left his wife, was living in his yacht, and he kissed me, and then it faded to black, and I'm sure we fucked for hours and hours. And then there's like a cutscene, which is the final, it's the very end of the game. And you realize, you sort of, each character kind of summarizes what you've done with them in the game and like what they've enjoyed or not enjoyed about your interactions. But then Joseph comes up to me and is like, actually, I'm staying with Mary. But, you know, we can have a thing on the side. And that, like, crushed me. He lied. He said they were already gone. And you know what? If he had said, listen, I've got this understanding with Mary, I would have been fine with that. But no, he wanted me to cheat on his wife with him. And I was super like, oh, gross. And I was surprised that I cared at all. But then the whole thing with Amanda, your daughter, when there are certain cutscenes where you can make decisions about how to interact with her, like when she's crying or when she's having friends over, like how you're going to discipline her when she doesn't text you back and stays out all night. And I must have royally fucked it up, because she went into this speech about how, you know, I'm going off to college and I feel like we were so close and you're kind of a helicopter parent and I never got to learn how to be on my own and I'm really stressed about this. And at the end of the game, my achievement was okay-ish dad. And I was like...
Wow.
Fuck me.
Oh, no. You weren't trying to be a bad dad.
I was trying. That's the thing that surprised me. I thought this was just going to be a funny game about fucking a bunch of dads who happen to live in your neighborhood. Like, they're all very silly characters. But, like, the...
Well, I think that's the beating heart of this game, and the reason that it actually works emotionally, and it's the sort of subtle brilliance of the writing and the way it's done is like, yeah, it's in on the joke of what daddy means on Twitter, and it's, you know, dream daddy and all of that. But the part about daddy is that it's also a dad. Like it makes you do both, right? And for kids who play this, I really think it sort of uniquely uses the tools of a game to like put you in the point of view of a parent in a way that does not feel cringy or pejorative or, you know, like after school special.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I assume we all got the same question early on. When they say, you're at the point where you're talking to Amanda and you're supposed to say, do you choose either when your mother and I adopted you or when your father and I adopted you? Did you guys get that?
Yes.
Which one did you choose?
Mother.
What'd you choose, Alex?
I chose father because I assumed then that there'd be an added like dialogue of like, oh, this is so taboo. This is new to me. And I just didn't want to go through all that because I wanted to get through the game quickly. Was that the case, Max?
What, for choosing
I'm sorry.
Mother?
Merlin, what did you choose?
Oh no, I chose dad. Well, I guess the reason I'm curious, and this is, I'm not fun in here. Like, I'm not into video games, but I am curious about the culture. So, Max, like, when you're playing a video game, in this case, obviously, I guess it makes sense to do like straightforward. You are you equals Max Temkin. But like, when you're playing a video game, what governs what goes into your character? Like, at what times are you looking for escape? At what times are you looking for change? When you're like monster factorying like whoever you are in the game, what goes into deciding the personality of the character you're playing in that game when you have the choice?
Yeah. Well,
is that a reasonable question?
Very, very much so. It's a really interesting topic. It really gets into how people play games. For myself, so just to speak for myself, it's complicated. You know, one thing about me is like, I don't like to watch bad movies. Like, I don't like to do things ironically or badly. I like feel like I don't have enough time right now in my life for that. Like, I just like to do good things. So I there is a huge culture of people playing games and like making a Monster Factory guy and playing it, you know, as a goof or breaking the game or whatever. And that is a major part of video gaming culture. It's not what I like. So I am looking for a game that is either... for me, what kind of pushes my buttons in a game is either A, something like PUBG, where there's almost no characterization and the narrative is completely emergent from the gameplay. So the narrative is the thing that happens as a result of what you do in the game and not something that someone wrote. And that very much gets me going. Or B, something I can like earnestly role play and have like a novelistic experience. And Dream Daddy is a very good representation of that second category. So I played it as myself. Like, that's my first playthrough, is I'll play it earnestly as myself. Like, when I played, like, even games like XCOM, you know, there's a light role-playing where you, like, build your squad and send them into battle.
Mm-hmm.
I take it very seriously. I, like, try and make a squad that has, like, you know, some people will do, like, crazy, like, put pink army fatigues and come up with crazy names and distort their faces or whatever. And, like, I don't know. Like, I have a lot of fun, like, building a good squad and giving them the best equipment. And it really bothers me if they die. That's the first time I play. Like, maybe if I love the game and I have time, I'll go back and play again and do a more of a novelty run. Like, okay, I'm only going to play with snipers or something this time. But I do, like, you know, like a little bit of a role play of, like, I'm going to really get into the story of this thing and engage with it.
Is this and I'd love to hear what Alex thinks too, but like, so like with, I'm not trying to be that like guy, but like, this is a topic that must come up a lot when smart people think about video games, the identity of like where you and your character, this has got to be something people have talked about a lot, right?
Yeah, only a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there's it's a problem.
Well, no,
it's a problem
I'm not being facetious.
It's a problem that's so poorly understood in games. So games cater, even though it is a fact that most gamers are women. Most people who play games for the most time are women. That's an indisputable fact that industry research bears out over and over. Almost all games are targeted towards young white men. And the problem is so ill understood in gaming that one of the common conventions of the industry is a protagonist character that does not speak. So there's nothing there, because they can't figure it out. So most of the top game franchises, you know how in Dream Daddy your dad says stuff and you're like, ooh, I don't know if I would have said that or whatever? Mm-hmm. That they deal with that by having the protagonist literally be a silent kind of killer.
You just make decisions and listen?
Your decisions are like, where do I aim the reticle and when do I pull the trigger? And what knee-high cover do I kneel behind?
There's also two facets of this, though, where... obviously, until recently, I had no choice to basically play a guy, but... it doesn't so much bother me in like a really fantastic world that like Mass Effect or something before they had the FemShep character. It was like, oh, okay. Like I'm an alien soldier or rather a human soldier hanging out with aliens, whatever. But it started to actually bother me when you could play a female character, but the conventions were just so typical, like long hair, gigantic eyes, really thick eyebrows. And then I would usually just end up playing with a dude with short hair because I'm like, that's kind of, I look more like that anyway. Like even the most recent Pokemon game, like even these, like, which is a bummer because especially like the games that kids are playing, like I, as an adult, I can be like, all right, I'm just going to play as a guy in this game, or I'm going to play as a weird genderless alien and it doesn't bother me. But like immediately you're forced to make a choice in a lot of, smaller Nintendo games. And that just kind of bums me out. But also,
and especially that it's a binary.
Yeah. I mean,
the tacit assumption that go into this question you're talking about of like what character are you meant to empathize with and represent as the player? This is like one of the many topics that Anita talked about in her very excellent series Tropes Versus Video Games from Feminist Frequency, and like she goes into it in great depth, the ways that that there's sort of like assumptions made that the default is a male and the ways that you engage with it. But one of my favorites, the one that always sticks in my brain, is just like over the top to the point of self-parody and that people should be laughing at this and it's not even noticed, is when you play a female character in a game, and I think she shows like, for example, Catwoman in like a Catwoman game, that you can always position the camera so that you're sort of like looking up her ass. And it's literally like a male gaze. Like her body's on display in a cat suit and you can sort of slowly pan the camera around and like look at the like invaginations of her like butt cheeks, right? Mm-hmm. But when you play a male protagonist, they almost always include a piece in the character model that she refers to as the strategic butt covering. So this is sort of a piece of Batman's costume, mm-hmm. like the cape that comes down that covers the butt, such that the camera cannot be positioned to look at a part of Batman that might make you, the presumably male player, uncomfortable.
Oh, my God, that's fascinating.
Isn't that interesting?
You can't look at his crotch either. It's very disappointing because like, you can see that bulge from a distance.
It's like right, a lot right. of, and there are teams on these big
trips. You should see the tick. The tick is rocking quite a hog.
Oh, yeah, good for him.
On these video games, these AAA video games that have like hundreds of people work on them, there are literally teams of people that figure out how to prevent the player from seeing the third
being confronted
person
with a male ass.
Ass. And there's also teams that do the physics for boob jiggle.
Oh yeah,
sure.
There's like engines and math that goes into doing a realistic boob jiggle. And there are games like that.
What's that volleyball
beach
game?
Volleyball game is the famous example where they literally advertised it by saying we have previously like unmatched physics engine for doing the boob jiggle of the female.
I bet that's a hard
players.
Problem to solve, like in actuality.
Well,
the other things are it's like Pixar. It's like first you figure out that you're going to know how to do fur, and then you do Monsters Inc. Right?
Yeah. So my wife, and my kid and I all use Bitmoji. We create a Bitmoji of ourselves. My wife and I have made Bitmoji of ourselves that I think mostly pretty much looks like us mostly, and I sweated that. I don't know why, but I went in, I sweated that, picked the right hair, the glasses, the sweatshirt, everything. And so my wife and I use that, and it's a fun thing we do. When my daughter does it, when she makes a Bitmoji or changes it, she has fun with it. So hers are always look like a devil. It doesn't look like her. But she's a fucking kid. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, she's 9 years old. Why does it drive me crazy that she doesn't make a Bitmoji that looks like her? Why do I care? Well, I'll make sexy black dad in this game I don't care about, but something as stupid as a Bitmoji. I guess what I'm saying is, like, I could see how this gets really fucking complicated. If people are not playing the game or taking it in the same way that you do, it must be kind of frustrating.
Well, it's like anything else, right? It's like if you spend a half hour on the character creator and like lovingly, you know, make a person to role play as and invest a lot of your emotional energy in this thing, and it's part of your identity and your self-representation, and then you pour yourself into the game and play it, and then you see someone else like making your character, you're like, well, that's kind of an insult to me, right? Because it's like, well, I really invested a lot of my identity and energy into this, and you're basically saying like, ah, fuck this, like this is stupid. And
no, I don't think I was saying that. That's not fair.
No, I'm positing.
Okay, I mean that's your opinion, but I mean I was not. Just so you know, it did not even cross my mind that you would be mad how my guy looked.
Let's just fine. Don't talk about me. It's with your wife, right? It's like you spent all this time doing the Bitmoji, and it was important. You put a, you know, even investing a tiny bit of your self worth and your identity into making this little thing, and then your wife's like, ah, pff, fuck that. My kid. Oh, your kid. Oh, sorry. Your kid will just like be like, you know, here's like a cartoon. I'm not really going to care about this. It's sort of like, yeah, there's a little bit of a wound there. It's like, well, wait a minute. Like, what about, like, was I wrong? Like, or, you know, am I like lame for caring about this thing? Like, you know, once your identity gets into something, whatever, even if it's as trivial as like a character creator or something like that, it's like you have a lot of like infrastructure in your brain designed to like convince you that you're doing the right thing and that the parts of your identity you've invested in are like worthy and important. And that doesn't always like work in your favor. Like, that's why when things become, you know, arguing about politics and religion, like people like lose all rationality because they're like, no, I've invested my identity in this. Like, everyone's wrong but me.
Well, I apologize. I didn't mean to do that. I didn't realize I was doing something insulting, just for what it's worth.
Oh, no, not at all. It's more of like, it's interesting just to see how people, you know, perceive their characters.
I'm no more upset about it than you are about your daughter making a goofy Bitmoji. It's just like, it's just a little like.
Isn't it fascinating?
Yeah, it's like a little like, I feel lame for caring about this now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. But we use them a lot, and it's like, ugh, you don't look like a devil. Why would you do that? And then I go, wait a minute, idiot. The whole point of this is to be somebody else and do your own thing. And it's like, then I feel like an idiot. Yeah, you're right. I'm the asshole.
Yeah, no, I mean, I also want to say the other thing about this is sometimes this discussion of like the character creator and people, kids role playing and stuff, it goes like way off the deep end and goes too far. And like, you get it from two sides, right? So on one side, you have like people saying like games are empathy machines and children are role playing and they're going to be a more empathetic, like a better generation and like, like, you know, transhuman. They're going to be like more moral beings because they like play with these characters. It's like, no, they're not. They're going to be the same people as their parents who listen to rock. When they said that their parents were listening to rock and roll music and it was going to melt their brains. Like, it's none of this stuff changes human nature. That's on the left. And then on the right, you have like Rod Dreher wrote an op-ed saying that letting boys play as girls in role-playing games is going to make them trans. Like, and he said that when when I was a kid, I played D&D and I almost believed I was an elf. So if you're allowed to play as a girl, you might believe that you are a girl. I'll see if I can find this. Chapo. There was a very funny Chapo Trap House reading series about this op-ed. It's one of the all-time worst op-eds of all time. But I'll see if I can find this Rod Dreher, like,
amazing
trans elf op-ed.
Oh, dear.
One day I woke up and felt like a gelatinous cube.
Exactly. I love those kinds of cautionary tales that are like, if everybody was as bad at this as I am, can you imagine what the world would be like?
Oh, my God.
Imagine if everybody were as confused as I am.
Oh,
let's make laws.
Shit, dog, I found it. It's from The American Conservative by Rod Dreher. Can your avatar determine your identity? I'm sorry. I'm stealing a bit from Chapo, but I'm going to just read a small amount of this. Early in my teenage years, I was a miserable nerd. One great joy in my life and in the life of my small nerd circle was Dungeons & Dragons. This was the early 1980s, and I was aware of the D&D panic in some Christian circles, but those weren't my circles, and my parents had no idea what I was doing. It was a heck of a lot of fun, and it became the center of my social life for a year or two. Yet I remember one night lying in bed trying to fall asleep, thinking about the adventure my character was having in the game. I did this a lot, and that night was no different from any other. For some reason, it struck me that the life of this fictional character, whose storyline I was narrating, was far more engaging to me than the actual life I was leading as a ninth grade nerd and social outcast. Now, don't get me wrong here. I was not remotely close to thinking that the game was reality. It was a bit unnerving, though, to realize that I preferred to live in the imaginative reality created by the game to real reality in which I was deeply unhappy with myself and everything around me.
Learn from me. Learn
this
from
character
me.
I played, I believe he was a half-elf, but I can't remember. Sure, Rod. Was everything I was not in real life but wanted to be. There was obviously no way to become a half-elf, and if I had started presenting in public as a half-elf, I very quickly would have been made to understand that I was living in a fantasy world and ought to return to reality. And then he goes in to talk about a New York Times about how the kids are allowing to they're letting boys play as girls and you can pick your gender, right? Which is like it's like one man. And then he's like it talks about someone playing a gay character in The Sims. And then he says, is there ever a time in one's life when one's identity is more unsettled than adolescence? Even though things are rather more diverse in 2016 than in 1981, we are still not in a culture in which one can declare oneself a half-elf and find oneself affirmed and even valorized by one's culture, including the institution of high school. We are there, however, with transgenderism and gender fluidity. What if the happiness I thought would be mine if I could have stepped into constructed identity of my D&D character with whom I had come to identify after months of intense playing had been offered to me as something real? How would I have reacted at 14 and 15? But there are no such things as half-elves. There are no such creatures as transgenders, genderqueers, and the lot.
Right. You guys, this is really bringing up some shit for me. I had a year of my life where a lot of my identity was formed by playing Monopoly. And I could have been a race car or a shoe or a Scotty dog. But I always played the iron. I played the iron until it seemed I might have been a half iron. I don't really remember. What I know is that to this day I feel the need to heat my cock and put it on the fancy dress wear. And I feel like if someone had been there to step in and say, there's no such thing as a half iron, right? There's no half iron or iron. The Scotty dog doesn't walk and the money's not real.
I was played as the shoe and now I can only get off to women stomping on my stamp collection.
Oh, I'm the bank.